welcome to The Green Room, a new fortnightly podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. My name's Carl. Thanks for downloading this podcast, and I hope you enjoy listening along. Every couple of weeks, we're going to bring you interviews with bigger members, leading names within the industry, and other experts, providing an in-depth look at the modern art of greenkeeping. Now, although you may be familiar with our monthly magazine, Greenkeeper International, this podcast is a brand new venture for Bigger, so we'd love you to get in contact with any ideas or what you may want to hear in the show, or if you'd just like to get involved. My thanks go to everyone who's helped us get this podcast up and running. Hopefully you'll hear from them over the coming weeks and months. This week, we're starting with an interview with Scott Reeves, course manager at Leyland Golf Club in Lancashire. At BTME in January, Scott will become chairman of the association, and so I sat down with him for a chat about how he got to this position and his hopes for the association and the greenkeeping industry going forwards. It's a really interesting chat, and I hope you enjoy it. Don't forget, registration is open for BTME, taking place once again in Harrogate this January. Spaces are selling out quickly for the Continue to Learn education programme. More than a third of available spots have gone already. So make sure you book your place and get registered. Continue to Learn and BTME are going to be our best show ever, and we're really looking forward to seeing you there. Okay, on to our interview with Scott. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you get into greenkeeping and what's that journey?
Well, let's think. We're going back some time now. I've been a greenkeeper for about 26 years. I went after school, went to university and what have you, and really wasn't so keen on getting into a career arising from that, which would put me in an office for the rest of my life.
What do you do at uni?
I did information management at university.
I don't even know what that means.
You don't even know what that means. That's fine, because I'm going to tell you right now. Okay, so we studied like database construction, expert systems.
I still don't know what that means.
Right. Well, you know,
it doesn't matter.
You know what a database is. Yeah, so that kind of thing. Information retrieval, information management.
Yeah.
Business things, library things, indexes. Really boring, tedious.
Yeah,
I know it sounds. It is a long way away from greenkeeping. I appreciate that, but that was kind of where I was when I left school.
Okay.
And I did 2 years of the degree and had the sense to realise that I really wasn't cut out for it.
You didn't finish the degree.
No, I didn't finish the degree. I'm a university dropout. Not good, is it? Yeah, shocking. But I was. So I was 21, 22 years old, and I just realised I couldn't do that from. In my life, you know, I'd gone to university because nobody in my family ever had, and I went to the kind of school where everybody goes to university.
Yeah.
And I'd done my A-levels and it was like, off you go. So I just chose something at random, really. But I 2 years in, fortunately, I had the sense to realise that I was wasting everybody's time, including my own. So I dropped out. I got a HND, I think, as a result of it, but HNC or something or other, I don't even know. And then I spent a year doing every kind of job you can possibly think of. Worked in offices, I worked in kitchens, I worked in, you name it, every practical technical job you can possibly think of, just to sort of kind of keep going. And then
trying to find yourself almost.
Yeah, by the time I reached 23, I thought, I know what I want to do, I want to do something practical. My brother-in-law is a plumber, and he worked for a firm that does like carpentry, electricals, you name it, what have you. And I asked him, I fancy doing something practical on that. I fancy doing an apprenticeship, either in chipping or sparking or plumbing or something like that. And he says, no, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. But my best mate, who I kind of knew from growing up, is looking for an apprentice, and he doesn't want a 16-year-old. And he runs a golf course in High Wycombe, in Buckinghamshire. And so he wants an apprentice greenkeeper, and I had no idea what that meant whatsoever. But so I went along to the golf club. The head greenkeeper came and picked me up, I went over to the golf course, and he sort of drove me around on the back of a quad bike. And he says, right, there you go, there's the golf course. You start on Monday, and it'll be this, this, and this. He didn't even ask me if I wanted the job or not. It was just like, right, yeah, you start on Monday, and we'll put you through college, and it'll be this, this, and this. Right, I went, oh, okay. Right then, I'll be here on Monday. He just came, and that was it.
What was he called?
His name was Jim Sutherland.
Was he old school?
Oh. He's something. He's, no, Jim is I'll always be eternally grateful to him for giving me my start in this job. He's still a head greenkeeper at Reading Golf Club. Oh. You know, I worked for him for about 2 years.
Yeah.
And the golf club was run by Green King, the brewery. So it was a municipal course.
Yeah.
So they had like the, I guess you'd call it like the license or the franchise or whatever it was to run the course on behalf of the council. And it was an awesome training ground because municipal course, so you could kind of get away with, you know, a few things. You know, it wasn't quite so restrictive as like a members club. But also we had an 18-hole par three and a very young team. So what that meant was that the one you had somewhere where you could go out and use all the kit, learn your trade, learn your skills, without, you know, it being a big problem on the main course where people were paying to play and whatever. You could go out and learn how to use a vertidrain, you could go out and learn how to use a mower, change holes, all those things. But also with the young team, so there were I think four of us under 25. And they were all younger than me, mega competitive and really determined to be good greenkeepers, these guys. They all had a head start on me. They'd all started when they were, you know, 16 or 18, and I was like 23, so I was older than them, but I felt this real urgency. You know, I was really impressed by their dedication and their professionalism, and we had a great laugh as well, you know. But I was behind, so I had to catch up. So it really pushed me hard to sort of, you know, try and get to where they were, even though they were younger than me. So I went to college on day release, in my second year, so it was 2 year.
What did you enjoy about greenkeeping? Did you know straight away that you'd found something?
So the first week in the job, I raked bunkers and dug holes. It was in April, so it was like we're digging out irrigation breaks and things like that.
Okay.
I've never worked so hard in my life, and I absolutely loved it.
Right.
And we were on chalk and flint, so digging is not like round here where it's clay, on the sand on the links where it's pretty easy digging. It was hard digging, and I absolutely loved it. Within a few days, I knew this is what I want to do. And I watched it, and it took ages for me to get out on the mowers and things like that, but I watched those guys going out doing that stuff, and I thought, that's what I want to do. I want to do that. Yeah. And then,
it was the hard work that attracted you to it, or was it preparing something? And
it's honest, yeah. No, there is that whole preparation thing where, you know, you look back, every greenkeeper says this, the sense of satisfaction on a Friday afternoon, you look back at the course and it's all looking pristine. Mm. That yes, without any shadow of a doubt. But really, I like physical work. My staff might have hysterics as they hear me say that now, but no, I like that. I like that sense of, you know, getting stuck in, fixing something, sorting it out, and putting it back to work. Yeah, it's a good feeling.
Brilliant. How long were you there?
So I was there for 2 years, and in that time, I did my MVQ2, and also did, because I said to you, I was playing catch up. I went to evening school at Oaklands College and did my supervisory, so I'm a level three as well at the same time as I was in my second year, because I thought, I've got to push on, I'm older than everybody else, I've got to catch up. So I did both at the same time. And the club also ran a golf course in Essex, or purchased a golf course in Essex. And at the end of my second year, I've been doing the job felt like 5 minutes. They asked me to, when Jim left, he had been running both golf courses. They said, we want one person at each site, would you go to Essex and run that? Which was a mistake. My career is not like this. My career goes like that.
Up and down.
So it seemed like a good idea at the time, because I was like 24, maybe 25, and I thought I knew everything, and I thought I could handle anything.
Yeah.
I'd never been in charge of people. There were a lot of things I didn't know. And plus, the golf course was going through a major reconstruction. There were 9 holes being completely rebuilt, new bunkers all over the place, and all sorts of things, new build of putting green and what have you. And I just wasn't up to. I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't ready for that kind of challenge at that age and with that lack of experience. So I was there for about a year, and at the same time, my mum died. So I just, I couldn't really handle it, and then I left. So I left and I went to work at Stockbrook Manor Golf Club in Essex still. I'd met my ex, then wife at the same time, so I was stuck in the area. And I went there as first assistant, and then I was there for about 4 or 5 years, and I worked up from to deputy to head greenkeeper under course manager. So that was a big prestigious site, country club.
So you've gone from basically a head greenkeeper role back to a greenkeeping role.
Yeah.
All right, that's
really
nice.
It was the best thing that I ever did,
okay,
to be truthful with you, because at the end of that year, I was so demoralised and I had no energy. My mum died of cancer, and it was quite a long process, and it really sucked the life out of me, and I was shot at. But fortunately, the course manager at Stockbrook, Mick Vance, who works for Aquatrols these days, who's one of the best greenkeepers I've ever met in my whole life, and one of the best head greenkeepers I've ever met in my whole life, in the sense of he knew how to manage people, he knew how to get the best out of people, and he's been a mentor to me, the best mentor I've ever had, and he's still a very, very good friend of the family. To my kids, he's Uncle Mick.
Cool.
And he sort of could see, you know, that where I was in my life, and that, you know, he rescued me, I suppose you'd say. But I worked for him for about 3 years, and then he moved on, but he promoted me twice within that time, and I was his deputy, and I absolutely love working there. It was one of the best experiences I've had in my career. He was really demanding, really high standards, and I really learned how to be a greenkeeper there, I'd be truthful with you, you know, how to handle it and how to manage people. But then, you know, time came along and it got to like 2000, and I was married and had a son by then, and I just felt it was time to move on, you know, and run my own place. So I went to work in Surrey at Chobham Golf Club.
Yeah.
And that was a great experience again, fully in charge, all on my own, you know, and it was a completely different experience to the first time round, where I could handle it and I knew how to handle people, which is a big part of being a head greenkeeper these days. And the team were good, and you know, we had a good, how can I put this, course needed a lot doing to it, but we improved it every year I was there, no question at all. And I'm really grateful to that club for giving me that opportunity to, you know, to really start my sort of managerial career.
Was that the biggest difference then? Not the greenkeeping side of things, but that you knew how to be a manager. That was the biggest difference between the success and then?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay.
It's knowing how to handle people, how to manage upwards, how to say no. These are key skills. Understanding politics.
Okay.
Managing
upwards, that means
so
the guys above you.
Yeah, you have to be you know, so your boss will be demanding of you, anybody, that's fine, but you need to have an expectation of them as well, and you need to manage them, and you need to understand what motivates them and what it is that they're looking for, if you want to be successful.
At this point, I'm just going to take a quick break from the podcast to tell you about the Future Turf Managers Initiative. 20 bigger members have been invited to the Jacobson headquarters next March to take part in 3 days of incredible education, and you can find the details of who's been successful on the bigger website. Like Scott said, the step up from a greenkeeping role into a management one can be daunting, and you're going to need a lot of skills that you can't necessarily learn out on the course. Bigger and Jacobson recognise this, and that's why each year FTMI offers a series of workshops with professional trainers and mentors to give bigger members the best chance of achieving success when you make that important next step in your career. To find out who's on the FTMI Class of 19, head to the Bigger website, and that's where you can also find out more information about how to apply for 2020. Back to my conversation with Scott.
What was your relationship with Bigger? When did you start getting involved with the association?
Right. I'll be completely candid with you now, because there's probably a lot of our members who may be critical of things that happen, or are downright fed up about what Bigger does or doesn't do, what their perception is of what Bigger does or doesn't do. And I've been through that in my career. And I've been through various stages where, so around about that point, I was quite committed to what went on, went to section events and things like that. I was very active in the Essex section before I left there. Then I got quite disillusioned because it felt like, you know, the industry is always going through changes, I get that, but it did feel like we weren't moving forward. It did feel a bit like the level of respect and understanding that we have from the golfing public was just wasn't there, and I didn't feel that Bigger was fit for changing that at that point. So I kind of like, you know, got a little bit disillusioned. But then when I moved up to the Northwest, I started to get a little bit more involved and set up turf clubs and things like that with former colleagues at other golf clubs and what have you. And that was really my lead into it. So we started, Warren Bevan and I, who was at Lancaster Golf Club at the time, he was the driving force, but he and I set up the turf clubs in this area. And we ran those from Garstang and from Myerscough for about, gosh, I don't know, maybe like 9-10 years, and they grew and grew and grew, and we did all manner of things, and it was really successful. And that kind of drew the attention of people within. So I was still a Bigger member, but I wasn't really very active at all. And then he and I, well, there were about four or five of us around about 2014 who felt that the Northwest section could be better. And that's not a criticism of anybody who was involved or is involved with what was going on. We weren't unhappy, we just thought that what we were doing with Turf Club could be replicated all over the Northwest and in the northern region, if you like, and that if we got involved instead of moaning, then we could make a change, you see. So it was a case of, well, let's just get involved with Bigger, and we'll get involved with the section, get on the committee. And instead of complaining that they're not doing the education things or whatever it might be, we'll make it happen. And we'll be the people who makes it happen. And so did that. And then it was pretty much a roller coaster from there onwards, really. Right. So that was, yeah.
You never look back.
No.
But eventually your career brought you here.
Yeah,
to Leyland. Can you tell me a little bit, well, how you got here, and then a little bit about the venue? Partly because there's a perception you're talking about Bigger, that it relates mainly to the larger clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And with no disrespect to Leyland, it's not one of the most famous
absolutely.
Clubs.
No, problem. Yeah, so just quickly then, I was at Preston for about three, four years. I spent a year out working in machinery sales. I wanted to see that side of the industry and what have you, and I thought that maybe would be the way my career went. But I did enjoy it. But I missed greenkeeping an awful lot. And going around a lot of golf clubs and seeing the camaraderie and seeing the teams and seeing what they were achieving or not achieving, I felt like, God, I really missed that. So opportunity came up here 12 years ago and I jumped at it, and the club wasn't in a good way, shall we say, and there was an awful lot to do, but we've been on an upward curve ever since. Let's talk a little bit about Leyland Golf Club. What I think the reason I've been here such a long time, it doesn't feel like it, it doesn't feel like 12 years, is that it speaks to me as a person, in the sense of it's, I feel at home here. It's a kind of club that fits my personality. The club was set up by Leyland Motors people in the 1920s, and yes, we've still got that ethos, that sort of honest working people's ethos.
Okay, yeah.
So there are plenty of successful people here, doctors, lawyers, you name it, but by and large the people here are like me. They're ordinary, honest people, and I would say that Leyland really is like the kind of clubs that most of our members work at. It's that they would, if most of our members would come in here and they would recognise the environment. We've got people who work at very, very high end venues, and people who work at, you know, very prestigious places, and at the other end of the spectrum as well. Leyland's very firmly in the middle. It's, and I would consider myself to be very firmly in the middle as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I think anything that our members go through, have trouble with, like whatever it might be, so I kind of represent our members pretty well, I would think, in that respect. Yeah.
Yeah. So you talk about representing our members, and you eventually have worked your way, so that to be appointed chairman.
I know.
What's that process like? How do you get nominated, find out, and what was your reaction when you found?
Oh man. Okay.
What
so,
happens there?
Right. So I guess about a year and a half, 2 years ago, as a board, we were made aware that, you know, we had to think about succession planning. Les has been chairman for 1 year in the previous incarnation of the role, and obviously in its current form, the 3 year form, with where we have a president as well. And he'd indicated that he you know, that we needed to look at succession. So we started talking amongst ourselves as a board, what the profile should be, what character, and Les had done the job in its current role for 3 years, and so it was a case of, right, we learned from what he thought was needed, so we need to think about, and I'll take myself out of this now, but you had to think about who could do it, was capable of running the board, the affairs of the board, who could provide that oversight, who was at the kind of club that would allow them to have the time to come and, because it is quite a big imposition on your time, who had enough sort of respect from his peers and was familiar with the business and all those kinds of things. So yeah, we could have looked. What we did was we sat down and we discussed it, basically, as a board. Mm-hmm. And I think there were maybe two or three candidates initially that were discussed, but at the November meeting last year, I think I was the only name that actually went forward from the board.
Brilliant.
I think other people were talked about, but very quickly either recused themselves or what have you.
Yeah.
I didn't meet the criteria, and then it was, I think Jim said to us all, right, well, I will need nominations either on a piece of paper or figuratively. And a number of people said to me, you should think about it, doing it.
Yeah.
I personally was kind of thinking, well, he would be brilliant at it and he would do a great job, or that person would do a great job, and
yeah.
I know I'm not daft, I knew I was a candidate, you know, and I'm not that self-effacing, but I didn't really think it would happen.
What was that like? Were you, you know, sat in a room and waiting for the black smoke to come up?
Yeah, pretty much.
What
happened, so we were sat around and we were doing other board business, because that meeting last year was absolutely intense, because we had the whole BTME 2019 issue.
Yeah.
That took a day, and there were other things as well, and this was a big issue for us as well. It's a big issue for the association. And so we got to that point in the meeting and Jim said, right, well, we've got to discuss this now, we've got to decide this. And so far I can say that there's only one name, and it's the Northern Region director, Scott Reeves. And that point, that was it, and I was absolutely gobsmacked.
I
my hair's standing up on the back of my neck, and I can remember it. Like,
was it sheer panic?
It was a very surreal experience. I'll tell you for why in a moment. But Chris, I remember vividly Chris Kennedy, and went, "Well, come on, then. Have you got anything to say?" and I think I stammered some platitudes about, "I'm so honoured, and I promise not to let anybody down," and all that kind of thing. But then everybody just went, "Shut up!" Like, give me like hugs and shaking my hand, and everybody was brilliant. And then we obviously couldn't tell anybody for like 2 or 3 months. I had to come back to the club and make sure that the club were okay with it. And Steve, who you met, the chairman, was absolutely, you know, so supportive. Always has been. Everything I've done with Bigger, where I've become Northwest Section Chairman, then board member, and then what have you, he's always been fully supportive. I have to say, going back just a little bit, the reason that this is quite funny for me is back in 2001, I think it was, we had a guy who was doing some contract work for us and what have you, and he was a well-known figure within the industry, and so I would have been about 30, 31 years old then, and he said, so, you know, you're coming up now, you're a head greenkeeper now, and you're doing all these things, where's your goal, where do you want to be in your life? I said, I want to be chairman of Bigger before I'm 50. I swear on my life. He said, well, why would you want to do that? And is that like that? Because it wasn't really considered to be the be all. It's a different role then. It was more of a sort of, here's a thank you for everything you've done for the association kind of thing. But my feeling was, and I genuinely felt that if I was in a position at that point in my career where my peers thought that I was worthy of doing that or doing this, then I would have got to a point in my career where I've achieved things and what have you. So I was 47 when I was elected chairman. And I'll be 48, obviously, in January when I become chairman. So there's a box ticked. Yeah, but I never actually thought it would happen.
Yeah.
Because you go and do things.
And when you're in the bar meeting, you're surrounded by a group of guys who...
Oh, my life. It's
major names in the
industry.
You're
not kidding. Yeah, I've sat there with I'm not going to drop names, but guys from some of the greatest golf courses in the country, if not the world, and they're asking me what I think about things. And I'm thinking... I'm just an idiot from Lancashire. I don't know.
Don't print that.
I'll say that, but yeah. Mm. No, I understand. Well, that's the beauty of the association, isn't it? From the highest club to the smallest.
Yeah, sorry. But what I take from that is, and what I keep saying to people, is that sometimes, and I've felt that what happens at the things that bigger does or doesn't do, and whether you think those things are good or bad or whatever it might be, you have the power to change that. This is our association. If we're not happy about something, then go to a meeting and make your voice heard, or join a committee and change things, or put an alternative idea forward. You will always be listened to. In our association, I don't know many other representative bodies, where the voice of the ordinary member is so important and is listened to and used. I mean, I know people who are members of teaching associations or medical associations, professional bodies of all sorts, and I don't know any of them where the ordinary rank and file member can have such a big influence on what the national perspective is, for sure.
Yeah, you've touched upon it slightly there. What do you consider to be the priorities of the what are the priorities of the association going forward? What are the things that you... What's your manifesto?
Well, to be clear on that, I don't think the chairmanship is about everybody come with me, I've got a direction and I know where we're going, you all follow behind. I don't think that's how... And somebody in my club chairman's position, that is exactly how it is. But with bigger, it's not really about that. It's more about making sure that the voice of the ordinary members is heard through the mechanism that we have, which is section, region, national board. It's making sure that the role of chairman is fairly well defined in our articles. If you're asking me what I think the more sort of philosophically what I think about the chairmanship, so clearly it's not to set my stall out and make sure everybody follows me. Having said that, what I believe are the priorities, one of the reasons I've been asked to become chairman is because my personal beliefs are probably very much in line with where the association is heading in the next few years, i.e. we're seeing greenkeepers under pressure for all kinds of reasons, from economic, social, mental health, demands upon them from what they've been being asked to, limited resources, you name it, we're all facing an awful lot of pressure. So what Bigger can do in that environment is provide people, well, first of all, with the tools to be able to cope with those pressures. Secondly, to influence at the appropriate level, in other words, with the powers that be within golf, which we are one, I should say. We're no longer, I think, looking upwards at maybe the RNA and whoever. We're part of that environment. We can influence things that they do. We can influence golfers now, Your Course magazine and so forth. Mm-hmm. But then also, that's the second front. And on the third front, if things do go wrong for people, we're there for them. You know, our membership services managers every single day are working with ordinary greenkeepers to, if something goes wrong for them, to provide support for them. You know, yourselves at Bigger House, we provide the services that people need, you know. We can put them in touch with the right people to cope with the things when they don't go well. So three fronts, really. And I think where I'm getting to is that I am, as we discussed before, quite sort of socialist in my outlook. I believe in the power of the collective. I believe in the power of professional bodies. I believe in the power of people helping each other. That's a very big part thing for me. So I guess those values are probably in line with where Bigger is going for the next few years.
Yeah, fantastic. How about greenkeeping itself, as perhaps as more speculative? What do you think the priorities of greenkeeping in general should be?
That's a really difficult question, because if you start talking about greenkeeping, there's probably as many points of view on that as there are people or greenkeepers. Where is greenkeeping going? I think there will be necessarily be a focus on less perhaps on presentation and more on, how can I put this, accessibility and resilience. So in other words, if you've got X amount of hours, then you can spend that time primping and preening and striping and doing all those things that make things look pretty. But probably where we're going is more into preventing things happening in the first place. So the focus will go back more towards aeration and top dressing and looking more carefully at when I talk about resilience, for a business like ours, and this golf club is a business, if we're an example of what I'm talking about, I'm not making my point very clear, but we need to be open. Yes, it's important about the presentation of the golf course, but if you're not open, it doesn't matter whether it's looking pretty or not. So we need to build in the resilience and the accessibility. So the course needs to be open. So we need to make sure that that it drains well enough, that we've got you can provide routes for people to come in if they want to use a trolley, if they cannot play golf without a trolley or a buggy, then you need to make the course resilient enough to stand up to that wear and tear. So that's where I think we're going.
So you're talking about greenkeeping being part of that drive to sort of secure the future and to drive the game of golf.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think greenkeeping has, and greenkeepers have not done enough in previous years to be part of the business side of things. So I get that you have to have a philosophy and you have to remain true to certain principles of not being throwing fertiliser and water around like it's going out of fashion. However, that there is a business element to that, which says in presentation is important because that's what people like to see. So, and you need to keep the course open because we need to keep the tills ringing. And so greenkeepers have to, well, before perhaps we were a little bit kind of closed off and, well, we do what we do, and the clubhouse and the bar and the pro shop, that's a whole other thing. We need to be part of that management structure. We need to be in the room when these things are being discussed. We need to understand what the pressures are and why we aren't being allowed a new greens mower this year, or why we might have to cut our seasonal out, or whatever it might be. We need to understand why those decisions are taken and perhaps inform them. I don't have a green committee anymore. I sit with the board of directors.
You fulfil that role, basically.
Yeah, basically. And that was my chairman's decision, because for exactly the reasons I'm talking about, where he felt that it would be better for the running of the club if I was sat in the room and I understood everything, you know, why the member marketing decisions were taken, why the membership decisions were taken. And that would give me a better perspective. I'm not saying that you just kind of throw out all your principles in order to make people happy, but we need to be part of the bigger picture. We need to be part of the management structure of a club, I would say.
One of the main pushes at the moment to grow golf is short game formats.
Sure, yeah.
Do greenkeepers have a role to play in that?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Even at an 18-hole course that's maybe not got a 9-holer.
No, but then you see you can create a course within a course, which is something that we've done here. So, you know, junior membership is very, very important to this golf club, always has been. So we've done things like, you know, we've got junior membership schemes and teaching schemes and what have you, but then this year we've put in an academy course. So a shortened course, but you don't have to build anything. You know, you're talking about under 10s perhaps who are playing the game of golf, or you can put some markers out on the course, which they're a bit of a pain to move and what have you, but then you put that out there and then there is a course within a course for them to use. I think that we get too hung up on things like men's tees, ladies' tees. You know, it should be red course, white course, yellow course, you know, so that flexibility within the game.
Yeah. In that case then, if you are talking about, say, the red course as being a shorter course and the white's being the long course, should there be a bigger difference between the red tee where they're literally staged? Because sometimes it's they're on the same tee box.
Yeah. Well, there'll be all kinds of, if what you're saying is in an ideal world, there should be a distinct distance, then absolutely. But really, the reality of most golf courses is that you're dealing with land that you can't change, and you've got all kinds of historic issues around where a tee is sited the way it is. But absolutely, you provide variation. Golf is not the same game as people started playing 200 years ago or whatever it was. It's evolved. And I think it's a bit like cricket. The test format is very, very important, and it will always be the purest form of cricket. But 2020, you know, all those kinds of things. Golf has to embrace those things. Yeah. I wouldn't even say it's like 9-hole golf, 6-hole golf.
Mm.
That's important. If you've got the layout on your course, so we've got a traditional kind of 9-out, 9-back
uh-huh.
kind of layout. So the 9th green is just here and 10th tee is just there. So that's great. So if you want to play 9 holes, you can. But we've got 1 and 2 on this course, and then 3 and 4 just over here. So you can play 4 holes here if you want to. We can just play 2 par 3s over and over again.
Yeah.
So if you can find, if you've got the flexibility within your golf course and your layout to do different things, why not? Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to think about why do you start playing golf in the first place? For most people, it's because they enjoy it. It's just meant to be fun. And I get that playing an 18-hole event is a test of a different type, like mental strength comes into it and battling against conditions and all that nonsense. But play golf because you enjoy it. Play it with a smile on your face. And if you just want to go out and play 4 holes or 6 holes, do it. Do it with your mates. And if you're not bothering anybody else, then nothing wrong with that.
Okay, so there you go. I hope that gave you a bit of an insight into what goes on behind the scenes at Bigger and in terms of how Scott, who will become chairman of Bigger in January, sees the future of the industry. I think the biggest thing to take away is that if you want to make a difference to your own career or your club, the only way to do that is to get involved in a constructive sense, find your voice, and who knows where you'll end up. Thanks a lot for listening to this week's podcast, which I hope you've enjoyed. Whether you're a Bigger member or a casual golfer looking to learn more about what it takes to maintain a modern golf course, we're really looking forward to bringing high quality interviews and features to you on a regular basis. If you want more information about things you've heard in this podcast, check out your latest issue of Greenkeeper International. You'll also find out more information by heading to the Bigger website, which is www.bigger.org.uk. Thanks for listening, and I hope to chat soon.